Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm honored and delighted to have church with you today. I have a confession. I am the daughter of a Baptist mother and a Methodist father, and I am a lifelong member of the UCC. My parents told me I could choose. I didn't understand what they meant. I thought I could choose anything, and I chose us. I'm also delighted to be in my sister Phyllis Wheatley's home church, Old South Church, to celebrate what might be her 260th birthday. It is indeed a privilege. I want to start by providing some background about Phyllis for those of you who may not know her beginnings. She was kidnapped from the Fulani in the Gambia River region of Africa at the age of 7 or 8. This bright, talented child arrived in Boston in 1761. The sickly and thin and frightened and forlorn little girl was purchased by the merchant John Wheatley and his wife Susanna. She was named for the cursed ship Phyllis that stole her across the Atlantic in the wretched Middle Passage, leaving behind a despairing and heartbroken mother and father. While Phyllis did not speak to the Wheatleys of her parents often, she once offered a scene of remembered prayers with her mother under a brilliant sun. Held in bondage in the Wheatley household, she was to be the servant of Susanna Wheatley into her dotage. But Phyllis was found writing symbols on the wall, most likely in Arabic, although they thought she might have been trying to copy English. Muslims were already established and were an influence in the African region from whence Phyllis came. The Wheatleys had twin, Mary and Nathaniel, and Phyllis learned from Mary to speak, read, and write English in 16 months and Latin within another year. She studied Milton and Pope and Greek classics. And upon her examination, an ungodly examination in 1772 by Boston's elite, she defended her knowledge and withstood an inquiry equivalent to the most grueling of doctoral examinations. Phyllis was a literary genius amongst a largely illiterate burgeoning country. Her first poem was published in the Newport Mercury by mid-1770. Several other poems were in print. While with the help of the Wheatleys and still acting as an unpaid servant, she attempted to publish her first book. Now, I want you to think about this. It's 1770. Very few people are publishing books anyway. During the dawn of the Revolution, Phyllis's appeal was intoxicating to both loyalists and revolutionaries. She knew how to please an audience and stay in the safe poetic spaces. Her genius defied the spin of slavery. The cruel and unforgiving state of bondage had to be sold in the emerging republic. Pro-slavery forces said that those enslaved were dociles. I wonder why they needed the shackles. That they liked their condition, needed to be enslaved, were too ignorant and lazy to care for themselves, spinning and weaving a narrative that has been hard to expunge from this nation. But gratefully, black and white anti-slavery activists and others who were in sympathy didn't entirely believe the spin. But nothing happens by happenstance. Phyllis's 1770 elegy, entitled On the Death of the Reverend George Whitehead, was published in Boston, New York, Newport, Philadelphia, and London. Reverend Whitehead had served as chaplain to an English Countess of Huntington. She was asked, because of her abolitionist spirit, to become Phyllis's patron, and she agreed. So on May 8, Nathaniel Wheatley and Phyllis traveled to London, where she met the aristocracy and the literati. When meeting with Benjamin Franklin, Nathaniel stayed outside the room, perhaps because both he and his parents were loyalists. By the way, the Wheatleys did not attend Old South Church. Phyllis chose her own church, Freedom Rising. Dr. Franklin and London newspapers were not kind to the Wheatleys, who continued to hold Phyllis in bondage. During this time, policy and law yet untried in England maintained that any enslaved person who set foot on British soil was free. I do wonder if this was a path to freedom that Phyllis did not have time to explore. Unexpectedly, she was forced to return to Boston early because of her owner, Susanna's illness, and she stayed with her until the end. Phyllis was finally granted her freedom in September of 1773, shortly before the publication of her book. Unfortunately, Phyllis did not get the opportunity to promote her book in England. Most people just didn't get a chance to see her in her element. So in October 1773, her book, Poems on Various Subjects, Religious and Moral, was published in London, and the reviews were anonymous and unanimous in their praise. Now, most people could never have afforded a painting, a piece of art, any finery. To have an image created was a sign of wealth, position, and prestige. Scipio Moorhead, a black artist, created a portrait of Phyllis Wheatley that appeared in her publication. Another powerful example of freedom rising in Phyllis's life. She is the first African-American to publish a book, the second American woman to publish a book of poems, and the first woman to make her living as a writer. Phyllis Wheatley was known on both sides of the Atlantic. She was now known in Europe and in Boston and in any colonial space where people considered themselves literate. With the fight for independence, Wheatley's professions of support for the revolution were clearly experienced in her poem dedicated to George Washington. Phyllis won an invitation and a visit with General George Washington, the leader of the Continental Army, at his headquarters in Cambridge. Phyllis Wheatley, a woman, a black woman, corresponded with and met with the first president of the United States. What a monumental, liberating moment. Soon thereafter, perhaps influenced by Wheatley, blacks were able to enlist in the war, some serving on behalf of their owners, and for years, much longer than white patriots. I also want to place Phyllis in the context of the black community and in a burgeoning network of northern coastal black communities. Get ready for this, folks. Portland, Maine, Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Nantucket, Hartford, Middletown, New York, Philadelphia. But here in Boston, it begins in 1638. The first African recorded in Boston arrived aboard a ship called Desire. with other enslaved Africans traded for and purchased in exchange for other human beings, including some 20 Pequot Native Americans. I believe that this is the date from which we can understandably comprehend the first anti-slavery sentiments arising in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. In order to survive slavery, Africans in America were forced to adapt and manage continuously. Like it or not, those enslaved captives and their communities developed an incredible depth of understanding of the meaning of freedom and independence and a powerful purpose from the beginnings of the country: liberation, education, and finally citizenship rights. Over time, these first thoughts of freedom became strategies that were eventually organized into a national and international anti-slavery movement. Imagine this picture: black men and women and children. I always try to imagine myself going through this, serving dinner to or sewing with their white enslavers. Patriots claiming American freedom who talked openly about the oppression of the British. Imagine what Phyllis felt and how creative she had to be experiencing such hypocrisy. The black community in Boston, especially those who fought as patriots during the Revolution, rejoiced at the Declaration and, like Phyllis, saw great hope and promise in it. While most Africans in America were enslaved, many black men in Boston and elsewhere joined the fight. They enlisted and organized two black units, the Protectors, who guarded the streets of Boston during the Revolution. The other was led by Colonel George Middleton, whose home is the oldest home that survives on Beacon Hill today. These patriots were so celebrated that they were honored in a ceremony and given a flag for their service in the Revolution by the Commonwealth's first governor, John Hancock. That flag resides at the Massachusetts Historical Society. During this time, the black community was led by leather dresser, soap maker, and caterer Prince Hall. Now, I know we don't hear enough about women, but I've got to try to help you understand that Phyllis's world is bigger than the Wheatley's home. Prince Hall received his freedom in 1770. The Bill of Freedom, written by the Hall family, said, "Always accounted as a free man," which means that nobody knew Prince Hall was enslaved. It meant that he was dressed like, walked like, talked like, acted like he was a free man here in Boston. He began to organize the first black Masonic order in the world in the 1770s and sold leather drumheads to the Continental Army. Hall raised petitions on behalf of the black community and advocated for freedoms, rights, and schools for children. Among his organizing principles, he advocated joining churches in order to sign contracts. While blacks were relegated to the north slope of Beacon Hill, his organizational prowess led at least three black men to purchase property there in the 1770s. Hall and his colleagues later established the African Benevolent Society in 1796, the African School in 1798, and finally the African Meeting House in 1806, one of the historic sites of the museum. Boston's black community organized some of the first black institutions in America, and the African Meeting House on Beacon Hill stands as the oldest space and church in the nation, as well as the organizing center of the abolitionist movement built by the free black community. It usually goes completely without mention that Phyllis Wheatley has strong ties to a black community in Boston. The great Prince Hall, as he was known in his lifetime, lived in the same community and was a member of the church just steps away from Old South Meeting House. Reverend John Morant, a black minister, was the chaplain of the African Lodge No. 1 and wrote his praises of Wheatley. For the first black Masonic order in the world, Phyllis Wheatley was their leading lady. I mention this community organized by Masons because John Peters, Phyllis Wheatley's husband, was a Mason, with whom she was acquainted for at least 5 years before their marriage on April 1, 1778. Peters is much maligned. Most people do not even know Phyllis was ever married and had 3 children who all died as toddlers. Her husband is accused of deserting her and letting her die alone, miserable and penniless, outside of the care of the Wheatley family. But Peters is like many black men in Boston at the time, especially Masons. He endeavors to earn his living as an entrepreneur during the depression that follows immediately after the revolution. Black men often had great difficulty securing employment, and Peters was no exception. Peters even allowed himself to go to debtor's prison instead of running away. He did not abandon Phyllis. The period Peters married at a time when most blacks in this nation were not allowed to wed, where the sanctity of their vows, should they make them in private or in public, were snatched away without regard for their family union, where children were sold away without a thought for their forever grieving hearts. In America at that period, Phyllis Wheatley experienced the most rare of sacred occasions, a legal marriage, and thereafter signed her name Phyllis Wheatley Peters. To acknowledge that union, I also want to suggest that we celebrate Phyllis Wheatley Peters and John Peters' 235th wedding anniversary. Now, as executive director of the Museum of African American History, I get to contemplate this history a lot. But every time I meet Phyllis, it is like meeting her anew. You should read Phyllis. She should be mandatory reading, certainly in Massachusetts, if not in all schools in the nation. Now, we celebrated Phyllis Wheatley at the museum as the mother of black books. She ignited a black literary tradition of pride and accomplishment. She lifted her voice on behalf of the enslaved. She was an exhorter, churchwoman, who found a way through her neoclassical couplets and letters to tell the truth, to write the record, to sustain the soul, ignite intellectuals, slay stereotypes, uncover the untouchable, and demand freedom, justice, and democracy in America. This churchwoman's life must be fully acknowledged, both her painful past, which began with her kidnapping, not her marriage, but we must also focus our lens on her triumph. As a leading lady in America and the world of literature, African-American agency finds traction in Phyllis Wheatley. There is no better example than this diminutive woman who remains one of the most celebrated and powerful examples of self-determined, self-organized, self-enlightened, self-empowered African-Americans through black books. In a year that commemorates the sesquicentennials of the Emancipation Proclamation and the first black troops from the North in the Civil War, Phyllis Wheatley's personal struggle with freedom is but an example of that which so many blacks endured. While her talents were monumental and singular, her voice spoke for many silenced by slavery. And her brilliance and publication sent a ripple of hope that helped to ignite a movement. Black people in America remembered Phyllis and often honored her, although their numbers were few here in Boston. The black community fixed their hearts, minds, and bodies to end slavery, and for education and citizenship rights. Even with all of the challenges of being enslaved for economic gain, navigating a society built on complexional differences, a new democracy, and the everyday struggle to survive, a self-emancipating spirit was stirring throughout the land. And in micro-liberations, in so very many ways, through education, uprisings, escapes, petitions, and black books, freedom was claimed in America. Over time, these stalwart souls, self-selected black men, women, and children, became abolitionists and joined forces with other like-minded white anti-slavery activists. Their churches, lodges, and organizations were the foundations of the communities that formed that network, and that network became a movement. Now, the greatest offense to Mrs. Peters is her appropriation as a monolithic example of the courage and capacity of one black woman as a genius amongst 4 million blunted and stunted, talented men, women, and children enslaved in this nation by the Civil War. Phyllis would ask more of us. Her very heart's expression through her poetry and her legacy is that of a liberating Christian life. Everyone needs to hear the full American story. Our identity and actions as a nation and a global society demand that we review and understand the history of this democracy, review our citizenship, and value every man, woman, and child. This particular history of Phyllis Wheatley is a matter of desperate concern to the identity of millions of American children of African descent and also African children. Where did their children go? But it should be shared with everyone. It is for all of us. Phyllis Wheatley Peters was a full-orbed human being, a woman whose enormous literary talents, intellect, and influence reached households throughout the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and the nation and Europe, a woman who, through her impressive poetic genius, shaped the daily existence and institutional realities of church, community, government, and literature. She was honorable because she found a way through her poetry and letters to tell the truth. Now, I want to say here that in this year of the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, it is sometimes hard for us to imagine that women and men reached back and got their inspiration at a time from people who were, you know, where there were so few volumes available and so little information sometimes known. But they did. They reached back and took their strength from a Phyllis Wheatley. 150 years ago, on January 1st, 3,000 people gathered at Tremont Temple and another 3,000 at the Boston Music Hall. They were waiting for President Abraham Lincoln to sign the Emancipation Proclamation. The telegram was delayed, and it was almost midnight before they learned that it had been signed. It was read aloud. Frederick Douglass said, "I finally know what it means to feel free." And I tell you this because they took off their hats and threw them in the air in celebration of that moment. I've asked Nancy to have us sing the Battle Hymn of the Republic because it's a song I'm reclaiming. It's a song I hated for many years. It was often sung in movies where you saw black people standing on a hillside like a choir of angels singing the Battle Hymn of the Republic. But I know the story now. Julia Ward Howe, another inspired woman, a woman who helped to inaugurate Mother's Day, went to Washington, D.C. to meet with President Lincoln and to review the sanitary conditions of the troops. It was just too difficult to go on. They had to turn back to Washington, and someone asked her, could she not write new lyrics to John Brown's Body? They're so depressing, and the soldiers were singing it. She was divinely inspired, woke up in the middle of the night, wrote down every word, and that became the battle hymn of the Republic. So this celebration today provides us with an opportunity to celebrate, to parade, to share, to study, to read Phyllis Wheatley, to reflect, to learn, to guide our living, our local, national, and global citizenship, attitudes, relationships, and our humanity. Surely by now we all know that there is much work to be done to keep freedom rising. Dearest Phyllis Wheatley Peters, happy 260th birthday, and congratulations to you and your husband, John, on your 235th wedding anniversary.